All right, we'll dismiss our kids to their classes. All of our little ones from birth to 3 years old right out here to my right, and everyone else up to sixth grade out to the ark. Also at this time, we'll have a couple of elders and their wives out in the hallway to my left, the west hallway, and if you have any need of prayer, then they are there for you, and so you can dismiss yourself at this time as well. We're so grateful that you're here, grateful for our guests, grateful for those that are joining us online, and we do have a lot of our women that are gone on the retreat. We've got a little picture that they sent me yesterday of the group out there, about a little bit over 100 people out there. We've got a picture of them. There they are. And so they're out there worshiping together out at Lake Texoma at the Prothero Center. Hey, fathers that brought your kids to worship, special kudos to you for getting your kids here. Open your Bibles to the book of Exodus. We're going to continue in that story, and today we're going to be in chapters 13 through 18. We've got a big chunk, but before we go to Exodus chapter 13, I want to share with you a couple of archaeological discoveries that corroborate what we read about in the Exodus story. I mean, this took place a long time ago, at least 1,200 years before Christ, maybe 1,500 years before Christ. The exact date of the Exodus is debatable. But we do have some evidence from archaeology that lines up very well with what we read about in the book of Exodus. Here's one archaeological find called the Papyrus Brooklyn. It is a list of servants in the Egyptian household. Now, at first, that may seem like, why is that such a big deal that we have a list of servants in Egyptian households? But among this list, we see several Hebrew names are included. They're all women, female names, which would be we expect in household servants. But a lot of these names are names that we see in the Bible. A lot of them are names that are feminine equivalents to some of the masculine names. And one of the names that we find, Papyrus Brooklyn, is the name Shipra. Now, that should sound familiar to you. That was one of the midwives. Now, no one is saying that the Shipra in the Papyrus Brooklyn is the same Shipra that is the midwife, but this is an indication, and this dates back to the 14th, 15th century BC. This is old stuff, but this dates back to the time before the Exodus, which means that there were Hebrews in Egypt during that time. And before this discovery, a lot of people were saying, hey, the Hebrews couldn't have left Egypt because there's no evidence for Jewish people ever being in Egypt. But this papyrus corroborates that there were Jewish people in the land of Egypt before and during the time of the Exodus. Archaeological discovery number two, the Nomads of Yahweh inscription. This is an inscription in a temple. It was found in the Sudan, which is just south of Egypt. But back during the time of the Exodus, this was actually part of Egypt. But this is a temple that one of the pharaohs built, and they have different inscriptions on the pillars of those temples. And on some of those pillars are listed the enemies of Egypt. And one of the groups of people that are considered the enemies of Egypt is listed, as you can see on this pillar, unless you can read hieroglyphics, you don't know what it says, but let me tell you what it says. It says that some of the enemies are the nomads or the Bedouins of Yahweh. And again, this dates back to the 15th century BC. Of course, Yahweh is that name that is given to Moses as the personal name of God. And outside of the Bible, this is the earliest attestation of that name, Yahweh. Again, letting us know that 1,500 years before Christ, during the Exodus, even the Egyptian people recognized that there were this group of people that just referred to as nomads, but this is very much what they would have thought of the Jewish people. They're just out there wandering around. They didn't have the big cities like the Egyptians had. The Nomads of Yahweh, again, recognizing the God of Israel. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing that we can dig up, I haven't done any of this, but people go and they dig up these artifacts and it corroborates with the stories that we read about the Bible. Man, I am convinced that the Bible is historically accurate. What we read about in the book of Exodus really, really happened, and it's great to have these discoveries that that validate those. If you're following in the sermon notes and on the app, you can find the sermon notes there. I have a link to a video. It's long, but it has these two discoveries, and then I think there's 20 different discoveries that validate not just the Exodus, but other events in the Old Testament. And so again, give a watch or a listen to that. And again, it's amazing how archaeology is corroborating what we read about in Scriptures. All right, last week we left off in Exodus chapter 13. We talked about the Passover celebration, that last plague that finally convinced Pharaoh to let the people go, the death of the firstborn, and then that ceremony, the Passover, which is even being celebrated to this day, one of the holiest days of the Jewish people, where they remember, where they never forget what God has done for them. With the blood on the doorpost, they were delivered, they were rescued from the death of the firstborn. And then Pharaoh says, all right, that's enough of me, and he sends them out. He sends them out, and the household owners are just giving the Jewish people gold and silver to supply them for their journey. But finally, they get out there. They leave Egypt. But things are going to be difficult. Things are going to be hard. This is going to be difficult terrain that they have to go through. And then when you think about it, the Hebrew people have been reliant on the Egyptians. It's been slavery, but essentially everything has been provided for them. I mean, they were working hard, but they didn't really have to make any decisions whatsoever. Everything was just given to them. And so now they find themselves in this harsh land, and they have to start making decisions on their own. They really have to grow up into a nation. Much like all of us have experienced after you graduate from high school or maybe graduate from college or you come back from the armed forces, and while you were growing up, your house was provided by your parents. I mean, food was there. I mean, you didn't have to worry about the bills, but then you're on your own and you're in a place. I've always dreamed of being on my own. I can't wait to be an adult. But then you start realizing this isn't as easy as I thought it was. You have to go through this process of taking responsibility, of paying the bills, finding a place to live. We even have a name for it, adulting. And sometimes that's difficult. It's difficult going from everything being taken care of to now being on your own. And so this nation that is formed, they're going through that process of adulting. What I want to do is I just want to tell the story as we progress in this great deliverance story, and then I want to go back and I want to look at three passages of Scripture that really speak to me about who God is, what He expects of us, how we need to live our lives, and how we go through this process spiritually of adulting as well. All right, at the end of chapter 13 and 14, we have the Hebrews, they leave Egypt. There's a note made there that they're carrying the bones of Joseph. This was a request that Joseph made at the end of the book of Genesis. Of course, that's why they're here, is because of Joseph's activity in Egypt. As they leave Egypt, they're being led, divinely led, by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Wouldn't that be nice to have today? You know, God, which way should I go? Well, just follow the pillar of cloud. Anyway, they're being divinely guided by God as they leave Egypt. You know the story. Pharaoh changes his mind. He said, what have I done? And so now he starts coming after the Hebrews in the wilderness. They run into the Red Sea. They've got the Red Sea in front of them. They've got Pharaoh's armies behind them. Of course, there's this pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that is protecting them from the Egyptian armies. The people are all up in arms. What are we going to do? God speaks to Moses and take that staff and part the Red Sea. We know the story. The sea opens up. The Israelites are able to pass through the Red Sea on dry ground. As they pass through, the Egyptian and their armies and their chariots start chasing after the Jewish people. And then just in time, the walls of water fall down and all the Egyptians are drowned and the Hebrews are delivered through the Red Sea. Chapter 15, we have a great song of praise. After this, the people are ecstatic. Chapter 15 is a song of praise. It's the first song of praise in the Bible. It's interesting that this song of Moses is mentioned in the book of Revelation as well. But it's the song of Miriam and Moses, just praising how God has delivered the people. And it begins and ends with this refrain: I will sing to the Lord, I will sing to Yahweh, that's the personal name of God, for he is highly exalted, both horse and driver he has hurled into the sea. And so they're just overwhelmed with joy. They're just praising God, but it doesn't take long for that joy and that praise to turn into grumbling. Throughout, they're in this wilderness. I mean, this is an unforgiving land that they're at, and so they're looking for water. They come across some water, but it's bitter. That's how the Bible describes it. They can't drink it. God provides. Moses takes some wood, and he throws it into the water, and all of a sudden, that water is able to be drunk. And so the people get that water, that provision from God. They go on a little bit longer to the end of chapter 15. They come to an oasis. They come to this oasis of Elim with its 12 springs and 70 palm trees. And God provides them this rest in the wilderness. Chapter 16, follow along. They're about 2.5 months into the journey, and the people are complaining again. This time there's no food. We have nothing to eat. And of course, we know the story. God's going to provide for them. He sends manna for them to eat, a bread-like substance that appears every morning. And then he also sends quail for them to have some meat. And this is going to sustain the people of Israel for 40 years. Again, as you know the story, they're going to be out in this wilderness for 40 years before they get into the promised land. But the manna and the quail, God is providing for these people. Chapter 17, they complain to Moses again because, well, they're out of water again. God instructs Moses, take that staff that you have. I want you to hit that rock there. And all of a sudden, water starts gushing out of the rock. And again, God provides for the people. Well, this time they run into another problem. It's not food and it's not water, but there's this group of people, the Amalekites, who are a little upset about the Israelites wandering around in their area. So they meet their first military battle. And so they go out into battle, and Joshua has kind of taken over the military aspect of this campaign. And Moses and Aaron, his brother Aaron, and then Hur get up on this high hill, and they're watching the battle. I don't know why Moses thinks this, but he raises up his hands, and as he keeps his hands up in the air, the battle belongs to the Egyptians. But you try this. Put your hands up in the air. All right. How long can you do that? I mean, if I made you do that during the entire sermon, in fact, I'm getting tired, and I've done it for about 30 seconds. Well, Moses gets a little tired, and as his hands start dropping, then the Amalekites start winning the battle. And so Aaron and Hur, they say, hey, let us give you a hand. And so they get on either side of Moses, and they assist him, and they hold up his hands so that the Israelites can win that battle miraculously. Chapter 18. Moses has a little reunion with his family. It seems that Zipporah and his two sons have been sent out for some reason, but again, they're together, and he also is reunited with his father-in-law, Jethro. Moses tells Jethro all of the wonderful things that God has done. Jethro joins with Moses in praising the God of Israel and praising Yahweh for delivering them from the Egyptians. But Jethro notices something about Moses. Moses, you look a little worn out. And Moses is worn out because he is handling all the disputes of these people, hundreds of thousands of people. Anytime they have a dispute, they come to Moses. And Jethro says, you cannot do this all by yourself. And so Moses gets a lesson on delegating. Jethro says, what you need to do, find some wise men among this group, and for those minor disputes, just send them to those other people. That way you can get some rest. You can only handle those more significant disputes, and Moses puts that plan into effect. And that brings us to the end of this portion of the story. As I said, I want to highlight a few scenes and see what we can learn about God and how we can just go through some of these difficult and hard times that we experience. First, go back to Exodus chapter 13, 17 through 18. Exodus 13, 17 through 18. All right, this is at the very beginning of the Exodus, the very beginning of this journey out of Egypt to wherever they're going to go. Of course, we know they're going to the promised land. They know that. Abraham, God told Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, this promise has been repeated. They know that they're destined for another land. Exodus 13, 17 through 18. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God had said if they faced war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went out of Egypt ready for battle. We don't know exactly the route that the Hebrews took as they left Egypt. There are several different theories. There's the northern theory. There is the southern theory. There is the Arabian theory. Those are three theories that I know of. There may be more theories. So we don't know the exact route of the Exodus, but we do know the way that they didn't go. The quickest and the shortest way to go from Egypt to Canaan would be to just go by the Mediterranean Sea, right up the seacoast, and that would be the most direct route. But God doesn't want them to go that way because he doesn't want them to be discouraged. I mean, they're ready for battle, but man, God realizes if the first thing they face is a battle with these Philistines, then that may really be hard on them. You know, sometimes God doesn't take us the easiest way. Sometimes God doesn't take us the shortest way to the promised land. You know, God is directing us, and sometimes we're confused by this. There's something in Acts chapter 16 that kind of resembles what happens here in Exodus chapter 13. This is Paul, and we know Paul was a missionary for Christ. He's traveling all through the Roman world, and he has a plan. I mean, Paul is very calculated about where he's going to go and when he's going to go there. But at times we see that in Paul's journey, sometimes he doesn't get to go where he wants to go. And here's an example. It says, Paul and his companions traveled through the region of Phrygia and Galatia. And then there's this interesting phrase, having been kept by the Holy Spirit from preaching the word in the province of Asia. For some reason, I don't know the exact nature of this diversion, but for some reason, it seems as if Paul had his eyes set in one direction, but the Holy Spirit redirected him in another direction. And that's what he does for the Israelites here. But God has a purpose for this diversion. He says they are not ready for battle. Don't we see that in our lives sometimes? You know, we can see the promised land. We can see where God wants us to go. And we can say to God, here's the easiest route. Here's the shortest route. Here's the route that makes sense. But some reason, God leads us in another direction. Hasn't it happened to you before? I know it's happened to me. What I'm doing right now is what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to be a preacher. I was looking at my high school yearbook just the other day. Todd Coteau, ambition to be a preacher. And so that was my ambition. And so I did what I needed to do in order to prepare myself for doing what I wanted to do, what I felt God was calling me to do. So I go to school, get my degree, go to graduate school, get another degree, and I'm all raring to go preaching. And so at some point in my life, I have this opportunity to, I'm going to go for it now. And so I was living up in Delaware at the time, Henry Ann and I, and I guess we just had one kid at the time, and Henry Ann was pregnant with Cena. And so I decided, all right, here's this opportunity. It looked like a surefire job for me. I mean, it was made for me, Freehold, New Jersey. And so we go out there and we interview, and I think I've said this before, I think I preached the worst sermon of my entire life as I was trying out for that. You may dispute that, having heard many more sermons than the people in Freehold, but man, it really didn't go well, but I still had this hope. I mean, God, this is what I want to do. And I'm from Massachusetts. I'm from the Northeast. We love that area, and we wanted to stay in that area. So I'm just waiting for the word to come. I was waiting for them to say, hey, you're the man. Never heard back from them. And so there's another opportunity in Hagerstown, Maryland. Again, all right, this is the place, nice, solid church out there in Maryland, a beautiful area, you know, again in the Northeast. I think I preached a better sermon, better class that week, felt really confident about my prospects there. Didn't happen. In fact, I don't even think I heard back from them. What is it about churches that don't get back with you? I don't know. And so I'm thinking to God, this seems to be the easiest route. This is what I want to do. This is what I've prepared myself to do. But he kept closing doors. He kept taking me a different path. Until eventually, he led me to a place I never thought I'd be. Texas. He brought me to Texas, and it wasn't to preach. He brought me down here, and at first, I was the campus minister at Grayson College. And that was a good job. There were some good things about it, but again, I really didn't feel like that was where I needed to be. I mean, that wasn't my promised land, so to speak. Until eventually, there was some spirit-led church that figured out that Todd Coteau needed to be a preacher. Park Avenue Church of Christ. And I got here doing what I always wanted to do, doing what I think God has called me to do. But let me tell you, it wasn't the path that I thought God was going to lead me on. That's what he does to the people of Israel. The best way, God's way, is not always the shortest or the easiest way. God's guidance may take you places that you didn't expect to be. But man, this story teaches us to trust his guidance, to realize that he knows where we need to be. And maybe he's keeping us from some places because it will be more discouraging to us. So always believe that he is bringing us to where we need to be, and stay faithful. Stay faithful. All right, go a chapter ahead, Exodus chapter 14. In fact, I'm going to look at three different passages here. Exodus chapter 14, 15, and 16. I'll project those on the screen here. It's Exodus 14, 10 through 12. And again, if you're following along on the sermon notes, those are listed for you as well. But what about all the grumbling? You know, each one of these chapters, the Israelites are grumbling about something. And this is going to be an ongoing problem for them in this stage of the journey, but even throughout the 40 years that they're wandering in the wilderness. First, in Exodus chapter 14, this is when they're at the Red Sea. The Egyptian army is now behind them. They're terrified. They're crying out to God, and then they complained to Moses, and they said, Moses, we could have just died in Egypt. Weren't there enough graves in Egypt, and you take us out here in the desert to die? Didn't we tell you back in Egypt, just leave us alone, we're happy here? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians to come out here and die in the desert. They just keep complaining and grumbling to Moses. Exodus chapter 15 and verse 24. The people grumble against Moses, saying, what are we going to drink? All right, they're thirsty, and they grumble and they complain. Exodus chapter 16. Again, they grumble against Moses, and this time they include Aaron in the grumbling as well. I wish we had just died in Egypt. And then look what they say. I mean, there in Egypt, we sat around, we had all this meat, we had all this food that we ever could have wanted, but you've brought us out into this desert to starve us to death. Grumbling, grumbling, grumbling. Now, I thought about not preaching on this because I know none of us have problems with grumbling, but just in case, I thought I should bring this up. But isn't it true? Isn't it easy for all of us to fall into grumbling? So how do we resist it? How do we keep from not being like the Israelites here and just grumble and complain? Well, first of all, I think we have to recognize that the mission is difficult. Life is hard. And even kingdom life is hard. Kingdom life is difficult. It's not easy going from slavery to the promised land. It's not going to happen in the blink of an eye. And I'd appreciate Jesus so much when he calls us to discipleship. He says, man, I'm going to give you a life that you've always dreamed of. You're going to have the abundant life. That's why I've come. I've come to give you life beyond what you can imagine. But he says, you also have to take up your cross and follow me. He says, in the world, you're going to have trouble. You're going to have tribulation. People are going to hate you. They hated me. They're going to hate you. Jesus admits, he's very upfront with us, that this journey to the promised land is going to be difficult. And so let's just remember, even as Christians, there's going to be some difficult times. There's going to be some hard times. This is not going to be easy. It's not easy living as aliens and strangers in this world. And so let's just get that straight. This is not going to be a cakewalk. And let's not glorify the past. And we do that, don't we? The old days were so much better. Things were so much better back in whatever decade you thought things were perfect. We have a tendency to see the past through these rose-colored glasses. And then sometimes I think we can even deceive ourselves and reinvent the past. And I think that's what the Israelites do. You know, when did they ever say to Moses, just leave us alone? When did they ever say, oh man, I just love all this Egyptian food? I mean, they're reinventing a past that never was a reality. And sometimes we do that as well. So let's not glorify the past to the extent that we think that today is so terrible. And then don't imagine the worst. You know, this is what they do. They go automatically to the worst case scenario. We're going to die. We're going to starve to death. We're going to die of thirst. Yeah, I know it was hard. I know it was difficult. But were they really going to die right then and there? You know, they just projected the very worst scenario in their lives. This grumbling is a pretty big deal. Now, God does not like grumblers. In fact, Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he refers back to the wilderness years of the Israelites. And he says, don't be like them. Right? They stand as an example for you not to imitate. And so he goes on, he tells about how they grumbled and they complained. I'll pick it up at verse 7 here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He says, do not be idolaters as some of them were. That's one of the other things that they do. You know the story next week or the week after. I'm not sure where I'll incorporate this. They're worshiping the golden calf right at while Moses is getting the Ten Commandments. And they're going to fall into idolatry on other situations on this journey. But don't be idolaters like them. They sat down, they ate and drunk and indulged in revelry. And don't commit sexual immorality as some of them did. That resulted in this terrible destruction. 23,000 of them died. Don't test Christ as some of them did, were killed by snakes. That's another plague, so to speak, that befalls them. And then verse 10, and do not grumble as some of them did and were killed by the destroying angel. There's 11. These things have happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us on whom the culmination of the ages has come. So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Then he reminds us, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. What we're going through, the Israelites went through, other people have gone through the same types of struggles that we're going through. But God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. He'll always provide a way out so that you can endure it. Grumbling's a big deal. And what really impressed me as I was looking at this week is that grumbling is put in a list with idolatry and sexual immorality. You know, grumbling, we think, yeah, it's no big deal. I mean, everyone grumbles, everyone complains. But Paul says, don't be idolaters, don't be sexually immoral. And we'll say, yes, amen, Todd, preach on that. But also he says, don't be grumbling. He says, grumbling can lead us to fall. Grumbling can lead us to forget that God is faithful. It's a serious deal when we grumble. Look at this passage in Jude, verse 16. Jude is a book written later in the New Testament. And at this point, there were a lot of false teachers that were starting to circulate. False ideas about Christ, false ideas about God, false ideas about the church. And so Jude is saying, hey, you got to watch out. You got to contend for the faith that was delivered to the saints. And so as he describes these false teachers, not only does he condemn the content of their teaching, but he says these people are grumblers and fault finders. That's all they do. They just grumble and they find fault. And then they follow their evil desires. They boast about themselves. But you see, it's not just the false teaching that makes them false teachers. It's this grumbling and complaining. Don't you love Philippians 2:14? Man, if you have kids, you must have used this one before. Man, put this one on your refrigerator. Do everything without grumbling or arguing. So when you find yourself grumbling, that is a time to really look into yourself. Some personal reflection. Why am I grumbling? Is it a lack of faith? Is it a sign of disobedience or selfishness? Am I thinking only about my own needs? Is it a sign of lack of trust? Take grumbling seriously. God does.
One more passage. Exodus chapter 14, 13 through 14. Beautiful, beautiful passage. All right, this is right after that first initial round of grumbling. This is right before the Red Sea is going to be parted. This is while the people are, they see the barrier of the Red Sea and they see the Egyptian armies behind them, and so they're scared. They're complaining to Moses, and this is Moses' response to that initial round of grumbling. First, he says, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. You know, when you read through the Gospels, this is one of the most often repeated phrases of Jesus. Do not be afraid. What is scaring you today? What is causing you to be engulfed and overcome by fear? These people have the Red Sea in front of them, the Egyptian army, the greatest fighting force in the world at that time, behind them. And Moses said, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Stand firm. Don't give up your convictions. Don't stop believing in the God who has delivered you. Don't think that, hey, I'm just going to give it all up and everything's going to be okay. Stand firm in your convictions. Don't let your fear, don't let your situation allow you to compromise your faith in this God. Never forget what God has done. Stand firm, and then you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. Start looking forward. How is God going to deliver me? What is He going to do? How is God going to work in this situation? And He reminds them, take a look at those Egyptians. Get a good look at them. Because after today, you're never going to see them again. And then in verse 14, man, what a gem. What a gem from the book of Exodus. What a gem from the Old Testament. What a gem from the Scriptures when Moses says to the people, the Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. You know, that word still could be translated, be quiet. Quit arguing, quit complaining, quit doubting me. And just be still. Back when my kids were young, when we were driving to relatives' homes, and we wanted them to behave in a certain way. We wanted them to behave properly. We would go over on the way down. We had this van that we would drive in, and we'd go over these, what we'd call silly rules. And so on one occasion that we would do this, maybe it was Christmas time, we were going down to Henry Ann's parents' house, and you know, what if you don't get what you want? You know, how should you respond to that? And so we'd go over some silly rules. We'll say, A, should you say, this is ugly. I will never, ever wear this. Should you do B, should you throw it in their faces and just cry like a baby and stomp your feet? C, should you say, boy, I hope you kept the receipt because as soon as I get back home, I'm going to exchange this for something that I like. Or D, should you say, thank you, and give them a big hug? And of course, they would say, oh, we're going to stomp our feet, we're going to throw it in their faces, ha, ha, ha. And then after they'd go through all that, we would say to them, but you know what the right answer is. Say thank you and give them a hug. You know, sometimes in life, we don't always get what we want. Sometimes life is a lot harder than we ever dreamed that it would be. Sometimes we find ourselves on a path that we didn't choose, and sometimes we find ourselves taking the long route instead of the short route. And sometimes we get tired and thirsty and hungry, even when we're trying to do our best to do the Lord's work. So, church, what are we supposed to do? A, whine and complain and stomp our feet at God? B, should we tell everyone how great it used to be and how horrible it is now? C, should we just give up our faith and just do whatever we want to do? This isn't working. Or D, should we fear not, stand firm in the faith, Trust that God is fighting for you. And be still. I think you know the answer. May you find peace and strength today in the God that guides you. May you find peace and strength today in the God that provides for you. May you find peace and strength today in the God that delivers you. God has a destination for us. And it may be difficult, and it may be hard, but we trust that He is Jehovah, He is Yahweh, and we will continue to follow Him with our lives. Let's stand up and let's sing.